This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Very special guest today on Church and Culture. Anthony Visco is a sculptor, a painter, a teacher of art. He is an expert in liturgical art. He's a devotional art consultant. He's the founder and director of the ATA for Sacred Arts in Philadelphia. He's from Philadelphia. But prior to that, he has had a very distinguished career. Graduated from the Philadelphia College of Art, got a Fulbright, lucky for him, so he could study in Italy, where he attended the Accademia delle Belle Arti in Florence, won various awards for sculpture, and he has since become probably the leading figure in America when it comes to sculpture for churches and other religious institutions, and we have a lot to learn from him today. Anthony, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dylan. Thank you for having me. Thank you for your invitation. It's very kind of you.
Well, I'm really glad that I became aware of you through Facebook, which, you know, a lot of people criticize it, but I think it's a marvelous way of meeting people that otherwise you might never meet.
And I completely agree. I've met some incredible people both here and in Europe. Liturgical artists, Catholic architects, amazing things through social media.
Well, you know, speaking of Catholic architects, back when I was running Crisis Magazine, I had regular contributions from Duncan Stroik, and I also had Duncan Stroik on my EWTN television show. I also had a wonderful article that I published entitled "No More Round Churches." And here's my basic question, Anthony, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
I'm a convert. You may not know that. I came into the church when I was 34. And one reason I became Catholic, I had been a Southern Baptist, was because of the beauty of the great art in the Catholic tradition, both in terms of its great artists, like musicians, sculptors, painters, and so forth, but just the general culture that nourished the apostolate of beauty.
Absolutely.
But once I actually started practicing in actual parishes around the country, I'd have one disappointment after another about the church itself, the architecture, the music, you name it, even the plastic art, whether that's a stained window or a bronze or sculpture or painting. And I just think, where has the taste gone? The taste that I learned so much about that drew me into this church. Is taste the right word or the wrong word, Anthony?
I'm not sure. There is an aesthetic, and there still is to some degree. I think one of the most beautiful things for any culture is when you can wed your aesthetics with your faith, with your beliefs. And we see that. That's a universal. Somehow, within the Catholic Church, especially within the United States, those two things got separated. Or the focus was on one without the other. The wedding was no longer. When you said the title of your article was "No More Round Churches," well, the thing is, if we were to say "No More Mass in the Round," that would have been a different thing, and that's where the problem came, because the Catholic Church did have round churches. We have San Stefano Rotondo, which is second century, but we're forgetting that you can't just say oh, well, we did it before, so let's do it again, without saying, well, wait a minute, the liturgy was completely different at that time.
There was that's a much better way of putting it.
All those things are if we're just studying it as design, which a lot of modern architects have done, and not link it completely to liturgy, then we have two separate things, and the wedding of aesthetics with faith is off. And I think that's what you, whether you're a convert or me, as they call them, cradle Catholic, we all felt it.
Well, but you're obviously had devoted your life to maintaining this tradition. You went to the heart of the Italian Renaissance and studied it there. And I, from what I've read about you, you deal with every possible medium, from painting to drawing, to plaster to clay to marble to bronze. Am I correct?
That's correct. Yes.
What did I leave out?
Well, I do mural painting, but I think you said painting, so that's all in there.
Yeah, I included that.
I design liturgical furniture, such as altars and ambos and things like that. I'll do your pattern for your floor, whatever it takes. I see it all as one, so it's kind of hard to separate.
So you can do every visual aspect of a worship space or retreat space or even a space in the home that might be set aside.
Private worship, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah. And you've done major work around the country. I see you did something for Cardinal Burke back when he was in La Crosse.
Yes.
And
that was
one of our favorite people. Tell us about how that came about and what you did there in La Crosse.
That's, as they say, your life can change on a dime. I got a mysterious postcard in the mail, and it was to attend a lecture out at the University of Pennsylvania here. And it was, I remember the title was, The Influence of Italian Architecture on America. And there were four guest speakers. And one dealt with the idea of the municipal architecture and civic architecture and domestic. And there was another guy by the name of Duncan Stroik, I'd never met. And he spoke about ecclesiastic architecture based on the Roman Basilica and where we are with it. Long story short, I was leaving, and an architect friend said, what are you doing tonight? I said, well, it's a great lecture, thank you. He said, would you like to join us for dinner? And he said, I'm seeing you next to Duncan. Lo and behold, one of Duncan's aunts here in Philadelphia, because Duncan's also from Philadelphia, he said, oh, I know you. You teach.
That explains the bow tie.
That's right. So he said, would you mind giving me a CD of your work? I'd like to give it to the then Bishop Burke of La Crosse, Wisconsin. His Excellency invited me out for a day, and here we are in this 17 acres of wilderness where now we have the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe. But at that point, there was just nothing. He said, well, I'd like to do the Stations of the Cross over there on that ridge, and Rosary Walk over there, and Dylan, I have to tell you, the thing that always stuck in my mind was, I said, Your Excellency, would you mind very much if I included some of the signs and symbols of our faith? And just to give you an idea of what a humble man this is, he just lowered his head, he folded his hands, he said, Mr. Visco, if there's anything you can do to reinstate the signs and symbols of our Catholic faith, you have my heartfelt gratitude.
Yeah, great. What a wonderful man he is.
Incredible. So, yeah. And then, of course, we know he went on to be Archbishop and then, of course, Cardinal. And but what a great client.
So what did you end up, what's the totality of, are you still the arts coordinator there at the Shrine?
When they call on me, yes. I will always give my support to them, any advice they need. And we just have that sort of rapport and relationship.
And what's the totality of what you created there?
The first was the Stations of the Cross. And this was before the church was built.
And that was bronze, correct?
They're in bronze. They're outdoors. His Eminence wanted them to be outdoors. Then after that, I did the Rosary Walk, which is also outdoors.
And those were porcelain murals.
Yes.
Painted, I assume. Painted.
Yes, they are porcelain outdoor tiles. His Eminence wanted them sort of more or less to reflect the Azulejos tiles, the blue tiles of Portugal, and just blue and white, which is keeping with the Marian theme there. And that was a wonderful experience to do.
Now, murals, of course, are part of the great Renaissance tradition of painting. You have the famous Giotto frescoes in Padua.
Yeah.
And at the Scrovegni Chapel. So in other words, when you walk in and you actually, if you were illiterate at the time, you would actually see the story up on the wall, the life
yes.
of Jesus, the life of Mary. And is that what you as liturgical artists continue to do, is to tell the story visually?
I think there's three things, Deal. It's not for the illiterate, as much as we, I think, that I think is for some of the art historians like to think the reason was. That's what I was going
I like it. Go ahead.
Oh, and again, it's always, and now we don't, and now, because we know how to read, we don't have to do those images anymore.
Aha.
Big lie.
Right.
Okay.
Good point.
By the way, I saw some of that, in the Michelangelo drawing show at the Met. I was very saddened by it. As beautiful as the work was, some of the writings about it were completely from that point of view. As if Michelangelo...
That we've gone beyond this kind of thing.
Yes. Or you know, he really would have never done anything like that hadn't the Pope put a gun to his head or something.
Well, this is a denial of the need for beauty, isn't it, basically?
Absolutely.
Which is a denial of our incarnatedness.
It's, yes, and so they look at his, there's no discussion anywhere in the entire exhibition about the discussion of why did he choose that kind of anatomy, because it's supernatural and he's depicting the supernatural.
I noticed that one of your lectures is entitled Nuditas, the Theology of the Body and Sacred Art.
Yes.
I don't want to go too far afield, but I'm fascinated by the idea of what you're talking about, a supernatural portrayal of the human body.
Yeah, there's two things. One is the use of nudity in the Catholic Church and why we chose it and why we can use it. I think the only ones that really did understand how to use it. The other thing is the body as it relates to idealism, realism, and the supernatural. And we're finding out now that we have photographs of many of our saints, that realism has crept into it, and it never was about realism. It's about a sense of witness that comes from their current state, if anything. So, can we depict saints in that realist mode? I personally don't think so.
Well, when I look at your art, and by the way, our listeners can go to anthonyvisco.com, one word, and look at photographs of his bronzes, of his murals, of his artwork, for example, in La Crosse, at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe there, and other major commissions Anthony Visco has held, and they're all very, very beautiful, if I might be so bold to say. But as you say, the depictions are far from rudely realist.
Thank you. Yeah, I wrote an article for Sacred Architecture Journal about what I call image and likeness. And, you know, the early church fathers would write about this and say that at the fall, we maintain the image of God. This is this incredible structure we get to live in while in time and on earth. But we lost the likeness, and that our job here while on earth is to do the best we can to regain that likeness. So my thinking is that when we portray our saints, whether it's in sculpture, painting, mosaic, whatever, we're not supposed to really depict them the way they looked in life, but now in glory, before the beatific vision. So there must be a transformation, because they were transformed. So why aren't we attributing that transformation? Whether it's idealization, whatever it is, you know what I mean? There's different forms of that the artist should employ. Michelangelo, as an example, decided to make it supernatural anatomy, beyond what we can really be.
Is that how you would describe the David in Florence?
Yes. Yeah. All those things of, you know, who modeled for it? Who cares who modeled for it? Really, it doesn't matter. It's not a portrait. It's not a portrait.
It's not meant to be a photograph.
Exactly. So likeness is not what church art was ever about, other than their likeness in terms of regaining the reunification of image and likeness. That's sort of like what we were, that really is a bit of what we were talking about earlier when we were talking about this separation between beauty and faith. It's the same parallel in a sense.
Well, when you walk into a church, a Catholic church in Europe, one of the old great churches,
mm-hmm.
you don't even have to be a person of faith to be swept up in the vastness, the sense of holiness, with the arches, the vaults, the stained glass, the spires, the Gothic spires, and then the murals and the sculpture, marble and bronze, the woodwork, the altar pieces, all that. I mean, you really just stand in awe that people created this out of yeah. love for God and their church.
Exactly. And you can feel that this is this was not the hired hand that did this.
I mean, there have been many a convert whose journey has begun by encounters with beauty in, you know, just in churches like that.
Sure.
Or in front of paintings.
I mean, it changed. I mean, even though I was growing up Catholic, to go into a church and see the sanctuary and the statuary, it was something where, you know, I felt the need to want to do that. I had no art training until I went to college, and even then I didn't get that training. It wasn't until I wasn't doing anything really even representational. I had...
Were you a modernist?
Oh, beyond.
Uh-oh. The sins of our youth.
Oh, yes. I showed some of these things at the conference in Chicago, the Catholic Art Guild conference, and I'd never get a Fulbright for what I was doing today, but back then, yes. I was actually doing things like going to dump sites and rearranging them before and after, you know, taking photographs, and I didn't make anything that anybody could actually possess, you know, all that sort of late 1960s stuff. Where, I mean, now I don't know if they call it performance art or whatever it is. I was doing it back then.
So, you would distinguish between representational and realist.
Yes.
Representational simply means. What you tell us? What does that mean?
Well, representational, and again, Pope Benedict made it very clear in spirit of the liturgy. One thing that the Catholic Church or the Church cannot really accept as its art is that the art must be representative. It must be representational. That doesn't mean figurative, by the way, and nor does it mean realist, because we have the great works of Islam, that incredible geometry.
Couldn't you just call it communicative?
Yes.
In other words, it communicates something of the faith in any aspect of it.
Any aspect of it.
Up and down the scale from the earth to the animal to the human being to the angel to divine trinity to the saints.
Yes. There's three things I think that are necessary. One is that whatever it is, it gives a sense of presence, that there is a congruity of parts, just like we were talking about earlier in terms of the architecture, and that there is a wholeness. And once we get to that sense of presence, we then can have a sense of witness, both individually and communally. And that's what I think happens in beautiful churches and beautiful architecture, beautiful gardens, whatever. We have that sense. And then once that is achieved, we have a sense of transcendence.
Let me ask you this question. Somebody, a pastor, a bishop, says, I need a statue of the Blessed Mother in our church.
Yeah.
And how do you go about deciding whether it's going to be bronze or marble or whatever? How do you decide about the design? Just what are the steps that you have to go through to create something? And I'm looking at a picture of one of yours that's on the side of a church, and it has Blessed Mother with, I believe, two angels. Three angels, actually.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And
thank you.
It's a very unusual design, but yet it's communicative. We know what it is. You know, we know what's being said. So what are the steps involved in getting that done?
Usually I meet with the pastor, and if he has a committee or something like that, and that particular case was the Church of the Assumption. So we knew, and it was going to be on the facade, so we knew what the theme was.
Where is that church?
That's in Atco, New Jersey.
Beautiful.
And then it was my asking, you know, can I go outside the frame? Because I did want to give it that sort of, again, sense of ongoing, where it's not contained, it's not a still moment.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot. I mean, yeah, it looks like it's not in motion so much as ascending, even.
Yeah. Well, I think, Dean, what you were saying earlier, is that's part of the problem with a lot of the more contemporary works. They're static. They're not moving. There's no sense of ongoing to them. And again, a lot of them, especially the catalog ones, they're made for safe shipping. You know, that's the bottom line.
Is there a lot of prefab in liturgical art?
Yes, there is. That started in the late 19th century, and for better or for worse, it's continued. And
I bet the Italians had something to do with that.
Yeah. And it's a difference between, again, when you go to these shops, you know, whether it's Italy or Spain or Mexico, or whatever, they're artisans, and it doesn't matter what they're carving. They're not vocational artists. They are good artisans and well-meaning, but it doesn't matter whether they're doing a four-foot chess piece for someone's gigantic garden somewhere, and then move over to a miniature David, and then a Madonna and Child. But they're as Sister used to say in the cross, Sister Kristen Marie, she'd call them off the shelf, not necessarily over the counter, but yeah. And you do. You go in to these shops there in these studios and say, I want that Sacred Heart, and I want that. And they're the same old ones we've been seeing for the last 100 years.
So you start then with a conversation that goes to sketches.
Yeah.
And finally you get a sketch that you agree on, dimensions you agree on, place, setting, et cetera, and you go to work. And how long, for example, did it take you to create this beautiful bronze in New Jersey?
I'd say it was less than a year on my part. Then, of course, you hand it over to the foundry. And, of course, it's not...
Hand it over to where?
To the foundry to cast in bronze.
Now, you see, you just sort of throw that in like we're all supposed to know about that. But we don't.
Oh, okay.
But don't get going on it now because we only have a minute left in this segment. How much time between giving it to the foundry and actually getting the finished product?
About 3 months.
And where's the foundry?
Well, there's two in Philadelphia. They're pretty much all over the world, bronze foundries.
And you have to, of course, stand there and make sure it's done right, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
I want to hear more about that from Anthony Vesco, who is a internationally known liturgical artist, after this brief message.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Our topics during Cresta in the Afternoon toggle between church teaching and then using that teaching to shine a light on our world. We'll look at Christ and culture, church and world, religion and public life, from abortion to Zechariah and everything in between. Biblical criticism, Hollywood productions, academic debate, family and love, prayer and spirituality.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Sports, lessons, classes. Can you guess the best activity for kids to sign up for? It's family life. Extracurricular activities are nice, but not nearly as necessary as time with mom, dad, and siblings. Research shows that parents who prioritize regular time to work, play, talk, and pray together, emphasizing simple activities like family meals, family chores, a regular family prayer time, game nights, family days out, have happier, better behaved, more well-adjusted kids than parents who sacrifice daily family time to various activities. Don't let the village raise your kids. Step up and reclaim your family life. For tons of great ideas on family rituals, check out my book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide to Raising Faithful Kids. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
Anthony Vesco, who is talking to us from Philadelphia. He's the founder and director of the ATA for the Sacred Arts in Philadelphia. And all that word means is, by the way, studio for the sacred arts. Let me ask you this. I've often wondered, which is more expensive, something in brass or something in marble?
Oh, they could be the same.
They could be the same.
And essentially because... the way they're both calculated is by the, if I could use this, folds of form. So you can have something that's very sort of subtle and simple of surface, and then you can have something that's very convoluted with deep undercuts and all those things, more like a Bernini-type Baroque statue. That's going to cost more, whether it's in bronze or marble.
Which is more difficult? For it to come out the way you want it?
I would say bronze.
And why is that?
Because there are... Well, one thing is you can do more. You can extend more forms in bronze. But it also means that instead of having one piece, you've got a lot of pieces to put back together again.
What holds... I'm looking at this... Blessed Mother with three angels, one's flying sort of flying, I suppose, on one arm, the other on the other arm, and one coming up from below. What holds all this together?
What happens is the parts are cast individually, and then this is why it becomes difficult, because you want to get back what you had. So the all the different parts, legs, hands, arms, wings, are all cast separately and then reassembled and welded together in the foundry.
And it's obviously welded together in a way that you can't see, viewer can't see.
No. Well, the welds are then ground down, filed down, things like that, and then it's given a patina. So it's one uniform color, but no, you wouldn't see them. So you have to, that's where the artist comes back in and with files and rests and hammers and chisels. And.
But you also paint. And when you, as a young man, went from Philadelphia to Florence, how long were you there? What did you learn? And am I right in saying it sort of set the direction for you ever since?
It was a life changer. I did not expect to see any of what I saw, didn't expect to learn all that I learned there. And it wasn't through school. You mentioned the Accademia Belle Arti, but I had to leave there because, again, the focus was shifting away from.
Oh, really?
Yeah, figurative art and, in particular, religious art. So
it was getting abstract.
Yeah, and so I decided to just go to the different churches, draw from frescoes, draw from the statuary, and. Visited as many sites as I could, and I stayed for over a year, and came back. And also, it was, the Sacrosanctum Concilium came out and said, oh, we don't have to do, it was interpreted, at least in the United States, and even in Italy still till today, we don't have to do that way. You know, that one line that says the church has no official style opened a floodgate that we haven't quite closed. And not that we have to close it, but let's just go over that one line again.
Tell our listeners exactly what you're talking about.
I'm talking about the Vatican II, the document, when it comes to church art and architecture. The opening line is, the church has no official style. No, thank God. It has no official style. We're not Byzantine here, where we can only paint icons a certain way. The church has the largest vocabulary of art and architecture known to humankind. We go from the most empty of all Cistercian churches and sanctuaries, where we have this full sense of presence.
Yeah, simple Gothic lines, no decoration. So
to Bavarian Rococo, where we're essentially saying there's no such thing as excess.
Right, I love that stuff.
Yeah,
it's very joyful. It's Bach, it's Bach. It's Handel.
Absolutely.
Right.
So we have these two extremes and everything in the middle. But the key to it was, not so much style or sticking to any particular period. But again, that investigation, I think modernism gave us a chance to look at all this. And now that I think we're into, if not head for even a stronger counter-reformation, in terms of art and architecture.
So the impact of Florence was that you felt pulled into what we might call the tradition, which is not of one style.
No.
The tradition has passed, as you said, through all kinds of styles along the way.
Well, modernism is a tradition. It's being passed on.
Unfortunately.
So we can modernism is a tradition. Sure.
Although, when I look at the religious art of Marc Chagall, it's highly communicative.
Yes.
So I'm not being dismissive of it.
It's definitely communicative. I don't know if I would use it in devotion. necessarily. But that's, it wasn't his intention, on the other hand. In all fairness to Chagall, he wasn't making it as devotional art that
no.
would...
It wasn't liturgical.
...to pray before.
Yeah, he was doing it as a piece of pure art rather than putting the art in the service of worship.
That's right.
Now, let's talk about that. When you are putting your art in the service of the church, of worship, do you feel like that puts cuffs on you at all?
Not at all, no. No, I that's something I think I realized while I was studying and living in Florence, was that my deepest appreciation for art was art that was in service, that everybody whose work I admired was doing it as a commission in context to architecture, whether it was civic or you know, secular or for some palazzo or the church. It still had this, it wasn't gallery art that was then purchased and put into a church or catalog art. It really was designed for that space. So the whole thing of art and context became a very real thing for me, and has never left, really. So when you were asking me earlier, if someone were to ask me to do a Madonna statue, how do we start? Well, if I see the drawings, if I see the blueprints, which is all it takes, and I see the architectural context for it, that I find to be most inspiring.
I'm looking now at your bronze of St. Augustine at the National Shrine of St. Rita in Philadelphia. And it's interesting that he has the head of an African-American.
Yeah, I tried to make him a Berber.
He was North African, absolutely.
Yeah, he's from North Africa. So I gave him North African features. And the pastor and director at the time, Father Michael, was quite in agreement with that. Mainly because so many interpretations of St. Augustine, you can sometimes can't tell them apart from whether it's St. Patrick or St. Augustine. All these old white guys with long white beards.
Right. And I think, I love your St. John the Baptist that's at St.
Thank you. That was my favorite one of that series. I saved him for the end.
Yeah, he's got a wonderful, astonished look on his face.
Well, they're all witnessing. I know it's hard to tell from those images, but St. Rita's in the middle. She is before a relief, a very static relief, intentionally static relief, of the Christ of Holy Saturday. You know, St. Rita, unfortunately, you know, wasn't canonized until 1900. So she missed the late Gothic. She missed the early Renaissance. She missed the high Renaissance. She missed the Baroque. She missed everything, you know. So she's, when she finally does get depicted, she's depicted always in front of the Christ crucified, you know, when she's receiving her stigmata. And modern research has discovered that it was more likely on this what we call the Christ of Holy Saturday, this resurgent Christ figure. And it also appears on her coffin lid. So we decided to go with that image. So St. Rita is accepting the thorn and the passion of Christ, and her three patron saints, St. Augustine, St. Nicholas of Tolentine, and St. John the Baptist, are witnessing her. So it's what we consider a sacred conversation.
Well, your St. Rita in ecstasy is quite moving. And the picture that I see is from the side, so you actually see her robes almost flapping or in the breeze. They're being blown by the wind. I guess the wind of the Holy Spirit coming from the
front of her, right? It is the Holy Spirit.
And it's really, again, like that Blessed Mother I was talking about earlier. That, you know, very sense of motion is palpable.
Well, I think that's something, I guess it's because I felt it was something that was lacking in these static figures that I grew up with, and I still see them around.
Well, thank you. I mean the kitsch? And, you know, the kitsch figures?
Yeah. I mean,
Anthony, I once wrote an article on Catholic kitsch,
okay,
in which I just derided Catholic kitsch, basically on the grounds that just because you became familiar with something as a child doesn't mean it's great art when you're an adult. And I got more negative response to that than anything I've ever written. They just, I mean, my readers came after me viciously because I was putting down this, you know, these things that they hold so dear. And I must tell you that when I'm on Facebook and looking at the pages of my Catholic friends, I just often cringe at the images.
Oh, I do too. I do too.
I mean, I don't know where getting any inspiration from any of those images.
And likewise, if I make a comment, all of a sudden the kitsch cabinet, who are you to say that somebody can't have a, oh my God, oh, that's terrible. You as an, you should be ashamed of yourself. No, okay. All I can say is one thing you know for sure, because this comes up in these, you know, different conferences and conventions about why don't we, Catholic artists, make some take home versions for all of, you know, devotional purposes. And say, stop. Because we don't know why. But when it comes to the
take-home versions, I love that.
Catholics have terrible taste. They will get the worst plastic hunchback.
Right.
Padre Pio, made in China, looks like Wolfman Jack. It's incredible.
I'm just glad you're saying it, because I felt fairly alone in this particular battle.
No. It's I just wish some Catholics would understand that with the take home version. You go into these shops and I can, you know,
it's just awful.
Understands it that there's always this thing where. It's the difference between what I call the epic and the folk form. The folk form is quite acceptable, but this doesn't even qualify as the folk form. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
You're being very kind in calling it the folk form.
But they're not even getting that one. You know?
No, they're not really even getting that. Because even the folk form can be an original, a one of a kind.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
they're not even getting a good folk form.
So I'm looking at these paintings here at St. Rita, which are of a different style than the bronzes, but we don't need to go there. I think it's interesting that you used one style for the painting and one style for the bronze. And all of this is quite beautiful and powerful and a very high level, including your wonderful Christ of Holy Saturday in plaster. And so here we have, you know, something that's quite extraordinary. It's of the type of art that people see when they go to Europe and they see the work of the masters. As the artist who did this, you must get very frustrated when people walk into a place like St. Rita's and say, "Give me the take-home version." It's almost like they don't get it.
The problem is with most of the work there, we don't have any take-home versions. A lot of the work I do, because of the movement within them, become very hard to reproduce.
It's not the same piece. You're making kitsch out of something that is at a different place.
Well, you know, I had a teacher when I was in art school who he was talking about scale, and I remember him saying he used Michelangelo's David as an example. Not that I was making anything, you know, nothing figurative at all at that time, but he said something that stuck in my head, and he said that no matter how well you would do it, that any diminutives of Michelangelo's David are kitsch.
Right.
That it is that sculpture, that 17 feet tall, in situ, that's it. You make these reductions, and And again, it was sort of the thinking of things are made in context for certain reasons. And the whole metaphor gets lost of this shepherd boy kills a giant and becomes a giant. Oh, that's... So again, it's...
I noticed that in the city of Florence, when they put the imitation copy out in the square there, it's of the same dimension as the one inside the Uffizi
Absolutely.
Gallery.
Yeah, it's the same one on the same scale, pedestal, everything. Yeah, it's true. You see reductions of it, and no matter how well done they are, they're kitsch. So
now, you must have students who are learning this from you.
I have a few. Yes, I'm doing private teaching now. I was at the Sacred Art School of Florence for 3 years, and then I decided to take this fall semester off. I didn't go this October, and stayed here, and because I had a request to do it, and I had some other work to finish. But I'll take, I think for now, it's taking groups over who want to just go to different places and draw. One thing that inspired me when I went to see the Michelangelo show last week at the Met were his drawings from the Masaccio frescoes in the Brancacci Chapel.
Right.
And you see this tradition of artists learning from artists, learning from artists, learning from artists. And we're not doing that in any of our schools. So
Teaching drawing? Is this generation of artists skilled in even drawing?
No, they're unfortunately.
It's all on computer, right?
It's pretty much, and yet I have to say, when one of the reasons why I left, well, it was also because of His Eminence Cardinal Burke, you know, affording me so much work to do. And I prayed over it because I was getting tired of teaching in these academies, secular academies. And he gave me such an abundance of work, I had to leave, which was wonderful. It was a dream come true. But we're not teaching the fundamentals, and I start to realize teaching anatomy and light and shade and perspective and all these things, how and when were these things formulated? And they weren't done in some art school, but they were people of great faith who were exploring art of the incarnation, and that's what it supported and still does. So I was always interested why I had students that would just be so good at it. And then a year or two later, they'd say, Mr. Visco, I changed my mind. I mean, it was great, and I'm glad I know how to do it and all, but and I realized I had nothing to apply it to. Absolutely nothing to apply it to. So this idea of an anatomically driven figure, whether it's drawn or painted or sculpted, with light on it, whether it's actual or implied, in a spatial context that has, you know, a depth to it, that feels like it exists in your space, that all came out of incarnational art.
There are people, though, who have caught the bug like you did and who are coming to you for training.
Yes, absolutely.
And can they make a living?
That's another question. I mean, I couldn't in the beginning. I certainly, once I made up my mind in those early days of Florence that this is what I'm going to do, whether the church wants it or not. I had to do it that way, whether the church wants it or not, and they didn't at that time. So I came back and got a job scrubbing mussels in an Italian restaurant. I didn't care.
Well, when you're young, I mean, my first teaching job was in a federal prison in Atlanta after I got my doctorate. I mean, I just wanted to be a teacher somewhere.
Yeah. So I keep saying, you know, if you do it, I have plenty of work still around the studio, and people say, well, what'd you do that for? And I did it because I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And so if you do it for, you know, your own devotion, as it were, for the greater glory of God, sooner or later something will happen. I live by, the old expression, every every good Florentine keeps his shop, and his shop keeps him. So you do what it takes to keep the roof over the studio and be a person of faith.
How much demand is there for the kind of art that you're capable of creating? I mean, obviously there are parishes being built all the time around the country.
That's an excellent question. We don't know because we're still trying to find, you know, we're trying to still find each other. There are people who are looking for artists and artisans to do this work. There's no central basis for this. I like we were saying earlier, I think Facebook has helped tremendously in this and has put me in touch with architects and other artists. But I think a lot of our newer churches are looking, don't know where. So look, we have to remember, and I've said this in a lot of lectures, most of our seminarians aren't even given 1 week of this sort of thing.
One day.
They're not, years of study. They're never told, oh, by the way, one day you may be in charge of building a multi-million dollar parish from scratch. Do you know how to read a blueprint? Do you know the difference between an elevation, a section, and a plan? A lot of it, again, with the liturgical advising, I assist pastors in all those things and work between the pastor and the architect so that everybody gets what they want, essentially.
Now, I want to remind our listeners that you have a website, anthonyvisco.com, one word, and that you can be reached at that website, correct?
Yes, I can.
And or on Facebook.
The website's way, it hasn't been updated for years, so my apologies. I got busy.
Well, that's good, but also the website is updated enough to gave me a very good idea of what to talk to you about. So anyone who is interested in, if they're part of building a new parish, building a building or retreat center or updating it, or if they just want to add something beautiful to it, they can get in touch with you through Facebook message or through anthonyvisco.com. And, Anthony, I just want you to know I reached out to you because my entire Catholic life now, since 1984, I've just been stunned at the bad taste of Catholics. And also just the basic lack of concern for what the integral role that beauty has in prayer and worship, that it has in learning, in education,
yes,
that we seem to go with our plastic Jesuses and our plastic Marys when we have this incredible richness available to us, which is our Catholic tradition.
Unfortunately, Dean, when you're talking about what people's comments, I think one of the harshest comments that was ever made was at the National Shrine of St. Leo Kasha, and a woman was coming out of Eucharistic adoration. I was working on the mural. She didn't know I had done the statuary. And she said, she just got her hand, she said, oh, and that thing, that belongs in a museum. It's brand new.
Wow.
Yes, and I didn't make any comments, but I realized Catholics, unfortunately, because we've taken things out of context and we're seeing great works of Catholic art in art history books and in museums, and not in churches, we're starting to associate that level of beauty with museums and not within the realm of...
Museums after they were in churches.
After they were in churches, exactly.
They were in churches first.
Exactly. So I think that's part of the problem. And again, it takes someone to say, no, wait a minute, you have to put that back in the church or see it back in the church or... I always tell students, I say, well, how do you start? And I say, you ask, who does it serve?
Well, Anthony, we've come to the end of our time, and remind our listeners, I've been talking to Anthony Visco from Philadelphia, who is a devotional art consultant and artist, a designer. He can help you rebuild your church or build a new one. Anthony, thanks for being a guest on Church and Culture, and I look forward to meeting you someday face-to-face.
That would be wonderful, dear. Anytime you're in town, please come by the studio.
You got it.
Thanks.
To all of you who are listening, we're going to take a short break and be back with another wonderful guest.